Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, you are listening to Rated LGBT Radio. I am Rob Watson, and tonight we are joined with panelists and expert journalists, Brody Levesque and the Washington Blade's Christopher Kane, and I'm very excited to have both these gentlemen on, and their viewpoints are relevant on any given news week, but this week they are particularly relevant because journalism itself is playing a big part in a lot of the major stories. Tonight we're going to focus on a couple of things that are going on. There are Supreme Court hearings going on currently. It is sort of a shit show, nightmare, spectacle, if you will, and we're going to unpack that and talk about what's going on and whether there is any real potential of this actually not being a foregone conclusion. But then on the sidelines, there are a couple of other things that are happening. A book by renowned journalist Bob Woodward has come out and basically laid out all the warts and dysfunction in the Trump White House. And if that weren't bad enough, the New York Times has published an anonymous op-ed piece by what is presumed to be a senior White House official that is talking about leading a secret resistance from within the White House and the White House staff itself. So we're going to talk to the gentlemen tonight and their insights as to both the ethics of everything in those pieces, as well as what the effect is in Washington currently. We're also going to touch on some other things, including the events in India, which have now made LGBTQ existence legal yet again, bringing a little more equality in the LGBTQ community around the world. We're going to talk about what happened there and the effect. Plus, we're going to say goodbye to Burt Reynolds, who passed away this week, or actually today, and get some personal insights. I want to bring on Brody Levesque and Christopher Kane. Welcome, gentlemen. Welcome to the show.
Good evening, Rob.
Well, thank you.
First up, I want to talk about Burt Reynolds briefly. Burt Reynolds is always, for me personally, kind of a personal icon, and I have to admit, not that this was the pinnacle of his career, but when he did the Cosmopolitan Centerfold, I was a prepubescent, probably in junior high school, kid at the time, secretly in the closet, but finding that Cosmopolitan and seeing that centerfold was certainly one of the highlights of my young my youth, albeit I couldn't tell a single soul what that meant for me and how exciting I thought that was. But he had a renowned career, and Brody, I believe you actually knew Burt personally.
Yeah, it's funny because I too remember that Cosmopolitan centerfold, and in the side, there's been quite a bit of discussion on Facebook this evening by some of our colleagues who actually posted it on Facebook, and then the picture was reported, and they had to take it down. I met Burt as a result of meeting Clifford Winger and his wife, Carol Lynn, who were two very preeminent special effects artists of what we used to call practical effects back in the day. And they introduced me to stunt coordinator, the late, great Hal Needham, who was probably the biggest influence on Bert's career. And it's interesting because it was a very small circle of individuals. And Hal had introduced me to another stunt coordinator, a young man by the name of Philip Tan. And it just kind of worked its way out. And, you know, when I first met Bert, it was kind of intimidating. And then you kind of lost that after a couple of minutes because he was incredibly funny. He was incredibly personable. And he just had this wicked sense about him. And, of course, my first exposure to him was the 1977 movie Smokey and the Bandit, which Hal Needham and the Wingers and Bert had all put together that particular film. And they had talked a relatively unknown second-tier Grand Ole Opry star by the name of Jerry Reed, who ironically I got to meet along the way, who of course sung the title to the film, the theme song. And I just found it an interesting thing. Bert had run, though, in later years, he'd run into financial difficulties. There was the extremely well-publicized divorce battle with Lonnie Anderson. There was the failure of his theater in Jupiter, Florida. You know, he had difficulties in Las Vegas. A lot of his possessions were sold. But interestingly enough, he became kind of the grand old statesman of actors. And as a matter of fact, he was actually slated to have a role in a Quentin Tarantino film that unfortunately now he'll not be able to do because he passed away. But Bert, I found to be just an interesting person. And he was one of these people who literally defined, you know, hail fellow well met. He just, that was how he was. And he wasn't a close friend or a close acquaintance. He was just someone that I met and that I knew. I had a lot of respect for it. And, you know, he had a very full life. He had an interesting career. And I really am sorry that he's gone. But he left his mark on Hollywood. And from all the films that he did, some of which were just incredible, some of them which were very forgettable, and others that were just kind of the way he was. So that's my little tribute to Mr. Reynolds.
Well, very, very good, and I'm glad you could give us kind of that personal touch. Brody, let's. I'm going to turn to you on the key points of the week. You know, if you want to go over any other headlines or any other happenings that we should be aware of before we go into our main topics. Brody?
It's been an incredibly busy week. I think one of the things that stands out to me is that as for myself as a journalist and an editor, it's just been, you can't miss a story. They're surrounding you. It's almost like the old standby joke of, you know, the southern redneck who decides he's had enough of trying to catch fish and starts lobbing dynamite into the pond and all the fish rise up and all he has to do is just kind of scoop them all up with a net. That essentially is what it feels like this week, at least from my perspective. The Kavanaugh hearings, of course, the release of the book, the op-ed piece, what happened in India with the Supreme Court, which I thought was especially significant because I remember that was one of the first stories that I worked on when I first shifted into the LGBTQ press at LGBTQ Nation magazine back in 2009. And then later we caught up with the story as it evolved. So there isn't just really one thing that just stands out because they all stand out. We're just living in a virtual news hurricane. This has gone past news cycle this week and a half. This has now developed into a news hurricane. And it's very difficult just to pick out one memorable thing because they're all important stories, particularly since I think in just a hard analysis of what's going on, we are literally beginning to see now daylight at the end of the tunnel in terms of what will ultimately end up probably be the final moments of the Trump administration. This administration is getting ready to implode. Whether or not the Republicans do anything with it or not is going to be the major question. But, you know, I'm telling you, come November, things will change.
Let's go to India first, since the other three kind of all feed into the narrative you were just speaking about. Can you give us, for those who are not in the know, what is the history over the past 2 years of India and its relationship with its LGBTQ population and their legal standing, and what is the significance of what just happened there?
Well, India is a Commonwealth nation, a former British colony that won its independence after the end of the Second War. But when it set up its government, many of the laws that were on the book and many of the statutes through the British colonial era were kept, including the country's sodomy law, Section 377, which basically punished carnal intercourse against the order of nature, and literally with life in prison. In 2009, the Delhi High Court struck that law down. And in the decision, the High Court wrote that Section 377 violated fundamental rights to life, liberty, and equality as guaranteed by the Constitution of India. And the court went one step further and, in its opinion, noted that the criminalization of same-sex relations, harmed the lives of LGBTQ people. However, religious groups and some individuals appealed that verdict from the Delhi court. They took it to the highest court in India, the Supreme Court. A two-judge panel of that court overturned the decision in 2013. But they also, by doing so, wrote in their opinion that amending the law was the responsibility of the legislature. And the decision also went and derided the Delhi High Court. And it said, and I'm loosely quoting, that, you know, the High Court of Delhi overlooked a minuscule fraction of the country's population. Okay. And then also the fact that during a 150-year period of British colonial rule where Section 377 had been enforced, less than 200 people had actually been prosecuted under the law. It came back. And on Thursday, a different panel, this time comprised of five judges of the Supreme Court from the constitutional bench, they overruled the 2013 decision. India's Chief Justice, Dipika Mishra, explained that the law had become a weapon for harassment against the LGBTQ community. Justice Mishra also added that discrimination on the basis of sexuality amounts to a violation of fundamental rights. The decision itself goes on for hundreds and hundreds of pages, but the major emphasis or takeaway that most people are catching on in the ruling is that the value of inclusiveness for LGBTQI Indians is broader in scope, okay, than even some privacy-based arguments in other sodomy case laws, such as the one that the United States Supreme Court handed down in 2003 in Lawrence v. Texas. What does this mean? What this means is that the High Court of India just basically cleared the way for LGBTQI Indians to be themselves. Love is love, but it's not going to necessarily overnight do it with discriminatory practices and harassment. And, of course, you have religious factions and, you know, other problems that go with it. What this does for LGBTQI Indians, though, is it removes a societal stigma of criminalization. And that's a very key point. That's something that, you know, happened particularly in the United States after the 2003 decision, but it was a progressive thing. I don't think that unless you've lived through an environment where your orientation is subject to criminal law and imprisonment, do you really understand how much of a massive relief this can be, and particularly in the diversity that is the subcontinent of India with its different castes and families and so forth. So it's a pretty big deal, Rob.
No, that's a very, very big deal, and it's I'm sure a relief for those who are living in India, and it's a broadening of human rights around the world. I want to go now to human rights in the United States as protected by the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court hearings. Chris, why don't you give us your kind of take on what's happened with the Kavanaugh hearings this week?
Well, something that I find especially interesting, provided the recent news in India, concerns Kavanaugh's record on the right to privacy. I think this will be something that we need to watch, because Lawrence v. Texas was decided, a large part of the decision was based on the right to privacy, which it's unclear whether Kavanaugh subscribes to that. It's actually pretty evident that he as a literalist, doesn't believe in the right to privacy that was established by the Griswold decision concerning birth control in the 1960s. So that's something I'm certainly concerned about.
And Chris makes
a
valid point, Rob.
Yeah,
very
valid.
It goes to enumerated rights. And this is a problem when you get insurers like Kavanaugh. And if you look at Kavanaugh's record on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and you look at even within the range of the body of work there, which is, I think, 307 rulings that he has himself authored, Chris is right. This becomes, in a larger context, more of an issue, because you look at a literalist and you look at someone who doesn't believe in enumerated rights. You know, this is a person, and we heard the argument today in the hearings that, you know, people are reading things, you know, into the Constitution. He literally had U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina sit there and pound away the point for him, because Graham kept saying that Roe v. Wade was hanging off of one word, liberty, and that's what the high court did. So Chris is right. This now becomes a problem.
Right. No, it's I just saw a recent, I don't know when this happened in the discussion with him, but he will not answer Senator Cory Booker's question about whether it is immoral to fire someone for being gay, which also kind of feeds into the right to privacy, et cetera, et cetera. What are you, both your takeaways from the Kavanaugh positions as we've seen evidence so far?
Another thing I would like to add on the subject of right to privacy, too, something that's been occurring to me is that, you know, there's been a lot of progress toward laws that prohibit revenge porn. And a lot of that is also based on right to privacy. So the whole idea that, you know, that you can't publish, explicit photos or videos of people without their consent. And that is a huge women's rights issue. And that's something that I feel also could be thwarted by the appointment of Kavanaugh.
Are there cases you see coming to the Supreme Court where, because one of the things, it's one thing to have that point of view or that perspective, but they need a case to hinge it on. Do you see those cases coming up to that level where he would have an opportunity to weigh in?
Yes, no. Absolutely. The problem I have with this, and this is one of the things that I have said repeatedly, and Chris, you can spin from this if you'd like, but my viewpoint is this, that you have the Alliance Defending Freedom, you have Liberty Counsel, You have the Thomas More Society. You have a couple of other independent, very anti-LGBTQ law firms that are already spinning up cases in the bullpen, and they have already been actively pursuing any kind of a case. And this goes beyond, you know, Jack Phillips and the Master Cake Piece debacle. These are going to be cases that go to the heart of what has suddenly become the new territory for the opposition, and that is religious freedom and religious rights. And I really, and again, as Chris pointed out, you know, Kavanaugh does not believe in enumerated rights, and this is where it becomes problematic, because if these law firms are able to put together a case that and bring it up through the courts, and they're going to intentionally target conservative courts. And here's the danger, and this is why I keep reminding people. They can fast-track these cases through these district courts because they're going to go into the more conservative court of appeals to run these things, particularly the U.S. 5th and the U.S. 7th, because they know that they're going to get, you know, a fast-track decision out of either of those. This is not a thing where they're going to intentionally pull a case for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the First or the Second Circuit. They're going to go after a circuit court that they know, okay, is going to throw it at SCOTUS. Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, both sitting on the court, both do not believe in enumerated rights, both being literalists. It is unsure whether or not the Chief Justice would be the new swing vote in this. And this is where I see the problem is. Yeah, there are people that argue with me saying, well, it'll take years to do it. I don't necessarily think that's true because, believe me, these legal groups have hit the ground running after Windsor, after Obergefell. They are going after cases like the Masterpiece Cake case. They have already actively been pursuing something that they can hang their hat on. There is absolutely no way that there would be any kind of complacency with these groups. And I don't know. That's just my two cents. Chris?
Well, and, you know, and to Brody's point about these, you know, these arch-conservative religious groups, I mean, I'm thinking about Scalia's dissent in Lawrence v. Texas, where he said, you know, moral opprobrium should be a valid basis by which law should be made. In other words, you know, if we disapprove of a certain sexual practice, that should be grounds enough to make law. And you know, we're talking about somebody now who is the most, who would be the most conservative justice next to Clarence Thomas. So, you know, it's not beyond the realm of possibility. I think it's actually very likely that Kavanaugh would take that same position, respective to, you know, issues concerning privacy and sexual morality and so on.
Well, I want to go back to the point, Brody, you just made. Will Roberts become the new swing vote? And if so, where do you think our prospects are with him standing on these kind of issues?
Senator Whitehouse kept calling it the Roberts Five, and I kind of disagree a little bit with the senator from that. I think that Justice Roberts will be more concerned about preserving his legacy because it is his court. Whether or not he's going to allow the court to run through that kind of process, I'm not sure. I mean, this is why I keep thinking he may, in fact, be the swing in that. It was pointed out during an editorial conference call earlier this afternoon I was having with colleagues that we were watching the hearing. We were wondering whether or not someone like Kavanaugh would come back if somebody had approached the court, and they were talking about Roe v. Wade. But it, to Chris's point, this could be easily another run at Lawrence v. Texas or something similar. Would Kavanaugh or Gorsuch accept a cert and then go ahead and run it for the full court, coming out of one of the U.S. Circuit Courts, particularly the Fifth or Seventh or, you know, even a lukewarm conservative court, the U.S. Fourth in Richmond? I could see them doing that. Now, your question, would the Chief Justice – be the next, you know, Justice Kennedy, for example.
Right.
You look at how the decisions were made, particularly in Windsor and Oglethorpe, as far as the LGBTQI community are concerned, and it does give one pause. But keep in mind, the right has been consistently trying to chip away, okay, at what they see as the base evil, or as Chris pointed out, the whole religiosity of this in terms of morality, okay? And he's correct. Justice Scalia did make a point of that, and Kavanaugh and Gorsuch both are in that same frame of thought. The question becomes whether or not the Chief Justice is. I'm not entirely sure that the conservatives on the court, particularly now that you're going to have the trioka of Clarence Thomas, Brett Kavanaugh, and Neil Gorsuch, you know, maybe being joined by Alioto, whether or not the Chief Justice is going to be completely comfortable with that. And that in turn, you know, begs the question. And, of course, looking at what we've been seeing in the hearings, and the hearings have been contentious, to say the very least. That's actually putting it nicely. They've been more than contentious, as evidenced by, you know, the open sniping we saw earlier today between Senator Booker of New Jersey and Senator Corman of Texas. So I think that your question is, could Roberts be the swing vote a la Justice Kennedy? Possibly. But the thing is it going to go with the winds of tide and change, or is it going to go with how the perception is? The most important thing people need to understand here is that both Gorsuch and Kavanaugh were vetted by the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society, and those are extremely influential, you know, groups of, you know, special interest on the right, extremely influential, and we're talking long range. That's the other thing, and that's one thing that if I have to give credit to the right for something, I will do it this. They have the patience. They map it out. They're in it for the long game. And this is where it becomes problematic for the left, because oftentimes the left has a nasty habit of in the heat of the moment and shoot from the hip. The right has always been strategic.
Well, speaking of in the moment shooting from the hip, we have protesters. We have, you know, the Democrats shooting, you know, kind of gotcha questions at Kavanaugh. Is any of that going to make a difference? Is this a done deal?
Chris, you want to take a shot at
Chris?
This first?
Well, based on prior conversations, I have a feeling that Brody and I agree on this. Unfortunately, I feel like, unfortunately, I think this is a done deal. You know, I mean, it's really unfortunate for a number of reasons. Among them, I think the fact that, as Senator Harris pointed out, you know, this seems like a justice who is not just idealistically driven, but also driven by a very partisan bias. So,
I would agree with that. I think that the most important thing is what Chris just said, and let me underline that. Partisan bias.
Well, I think it goes even deeper. I think this was a done deal at the last election. I think this was why many of us were very adamant behind the Clinton candidacy, because we saw exactly this scenario as being an inevitability upon her being defeated. And I think that's some of the frustration that a lot of us have had over the people, especially in the key states that went for Trump, that chose to vote for Jill Stein or not vote at all because they were, you know, Bernie or nobody, and that this is the ultimate result of that. And in my mind, the train left the station.
Well, and I'd also point out that part of this fault lies with the former president of the United States. If you want to hang the court mess on anyone, you can blame President Obama, because once it became evident that the Republicans absolutely were not going to follow their constitutional duties as outlined, and they pulled the stump they pulled and basically waited for the next go-around. You know, there were mechanisms and there were ways that the president could have potentially put Justice Garland in that seat. Not that it would take away from the argument we're having now about Justice Kavanaugh. Trust me, it wouldn't. But then it would just be a simple thing of Kavanaugh simply replacing Scalia, if you will. But, you know, the fault lies with the previous administration for not directly confronting. And this is really a problem that goes back to, you know, over the last few days, we've seen a tremendous amount of pushback coming from the Democrats. But it's the absolute definition of too little, too late. And the truth of the matter is, Brett Kavanaugh will be an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. I don't want to take and put the blame on the Republicans for this, because at the end of the day, this is not the Republicans' fault. This is the fault of the Democrats, the progressives, the Greens. This is the fault of the people that sat the election out. This is the fault of people who don't go and vote. You know, there's a small core group of very loyal activists and progressives, and they move and shake things. You and I know many of them. Chris, you and I know quite a few around Washington, mm-hmm. like John Becker, for example. But at the end of the day, if you want to be fair about this and do a hard analysis of this, the fault lies with the left. The right hasn't changed colors. It still has the same stripes, the same spots, the same bangs, however you want to categorize it. Okay? There's no change there. The change is for whatever reason, the left seems to think, well, we can slide this by on the better nature. And you've got people like me that have been screaming for years and years and years, you know, quit drinking the better nature Kool-Aid. These people love authoritarian rubbish. These people live for their Christian supremacy. These people live for their xenophobia, their racism. You know, everybody screams about Trump. Trump is the symptom. Now, granted, there's a few issues with him. But the larger disease isn't the president of the United States. The larger disease is the American body politic. And what's really, quite frankly, not helping that much at all is my profession. Because for too long, we've not held these people accountable through the entire process. So when you see the circus that has evolved in the last few days over the Kavanaugh hearing, I look at that and I go, this is to be expected. The question is, what do you do now to change it? What do you make it better?
Right.
And how do you put the brakes on the train wreck? That's the question. And come November, the biggest solution I can think of for the American people would be for them to at least get the House of Representatives away from the Republicans, because at a minimum, that should lock up the Senate a little bit. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. In fact, somebody made a comment online about how the Republicans could sit back and allow a president like Trump and listed all of his sins to nominate somebody like Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. And my response to them was, this is the payback. This is the ticket. This is why they let him get away with all they've let him, because this is his gift to them. They want this. This is what they've been lining up for. I mean, this is the plan. I mean, exactly the points that you just made. And I agree with you. It's like our best bet is to take back the House, try to take back the Senate if possible, or, at least set the stage. But hoping for, some sensibility from Justice Roberts, as a potential swing vote. And also, Clarence Thomas, may not be around for all that much longer himself. I mean, he's getting up there and has their issues. So it's, this grasp of this majority may not be forever, although Ginsburg is certainly at risk as well. But we have to push forward. But pushing forward and forward, let's go to some of the other things that have happened this week. A book came out. Brody, I think you're close to this. Tell us about the Woodward book.
Bob Woodward's book, Fear, is the usual Bob Woodward, extremely thorough, well-documented, recorded every interview, persistent investigative journalism that he's famed for. And it takes a direct shot at what is pretty much common knowledge in the halls of Congress on both sides of the aisle, what is certainly common knowledge to anyone working in either of the EOBs or the West Wing, or the residents for that matter, and that is that the President of the United States is a psychopathic, lying, okay, mentally challenged moron. And, you know, it's unfortunate, but that's exactly what it is. Woodward paints a picture that most of us, at least in the Washington press corps, and Chris, I'm sure you've heard this too, have known for a long time, that White House has operated as a White House of committee. And the principal reason is because there hasn't been any real control over the West Wing in particular. When you have an individual like Trump with a volcanic temper, limited comprehensive skills and understanding of the intricacies and the complexities of the American government, the American military, foreign policy, the list goes on ad infinitum nauseum. It is ripe, okay, for having all sorts of issues. What people also aren't seeing, and my dear friend, who's an analyst, Bryn Tannehill, has pointed out more than once, is that waiting in the wings and also sitting stirring up trouble too is a Christian supremacist dominionist who is a purist in terms of wanting government that would probably make the Puritans proud, and that's the Vice President of the United States. So what Bob's book basically did was say, here's the reality. Here's everything that's going on. We have papers being taken off the desk so the guy doesn't start, you know, a diplomatic incident. We have people almost to the point of hiding the football from him. I mean, it literally has gotten kind of that bad a couple of times. Yeah, it paints a picture of the chaotic nature of an administration that is just completely spiraling more and more rapidly out of control. It was already out of control from day one because of the narcissistic egomania of the guy sitting behind the Resolute desk in Yale, but it's just gotten worse. Granted, some of the worst of the toadies and sycophants, okay, were either fired or removed or, you know, they left on their own accord, whatever the case may be. But unfortunately, you're still left with another group, and then you've got a cabinet that doesn't seem to be able to maintain any semblance of control. Each and every one of them has their own agenda. You can clearly see the damage they're doing. And at the same time, while the three-ring circus is going on, you have a White House chief of staff who may have been a brilliant military commander, but when it comes down to being a White House chief of staff, this guy sucks. He's got no control at all whatsoever over the staff. So what Bob did was he documented it. I think picking the word fear for a title on Woodward's, you know, part was probably smart, because what's going on should actually cause fear into the American people, particularly when you consider that longtime American allies, including my own government in Ottawa, the government in London, the government in Paris, the government in Berlin, are all now hands off with the Americans because of the complete and total unpredictable nature of not just the person sitting behind the Resolute desk in the Oval, but the entire American government.
So this book has come out and laid bare everything that you just described, and to literally pour salt onto this gaping flesh wound of the credibility of this administration, out comes the New York Times with an op-ed piece by an anonymous senior White House official talking about a secret alternate resistance, not the same as the liberal resistance, but an alternate resistance that claims is going on behind the scenes in the Trump administration. Chris, why don't we go to you on that? What is your take on that? And then Brody, definitely want to circle back to you.
So first, if I could, I wanted to make another point about the Woodward book that really jumped out to me. And it's something that hadn't really occurred to me before. But Woodward in this book was asking why Comey introduced the Steele dossier. And he writes, and I'm quoting, "It would be as if I had reported and written one of the most serious complex stories for the Washington Post that I had ever done, and then provided an appendix of unverified allegations. Oh, by the way, here is a to-do list for further reporting, and we're publishing it." That was among the most interesting things to me concerning the Woodward book. I mean, I think his reporting about the Mueller investigation was really fascinating. But to get to your question, you know, there's been so much speculation about who the author might have been. And my gut feeling is that, you know, especially given the timing of these two things, you know, the publishing of this Woodward book and the New York Times op-ed, I suspect that one of the sources, one of the main sources from the Woodward book may have also written the op-ed, somebody like Gary Cohn or what was the name of the guy who, Rob Porter or perhaps Reince Priebus. That's my guess anyway.
Brody, what were your thoughts on the New York Times piece?
For our listeners, I think this is something that's kind of terribly important. You know, in professional lingo, we as journalists have a tendency to attribute things, and we'll do it, you know, a senior White House official said, or a senior staffer said, or an official who was not authorized to speak, a person close to. And one of the reasons we do that, obviously, is because it's a condition of being able to tell their story and their partner's story. And the other part of it is to frame the context of the overall aspects of the story. Now, I know the New York Times really well. I am familiar, for example, and very well acquainted with their White House correspondent, Washington Bureau Chief Pete Baker. Maggie, I know her as well. I know quite a few of the crew of, you know, the old gray lady. There is absolutely no way that a second or third tier administration official would have been granted the privilege of being able to publish that. That tells me, predicated on my working knowledge of how the New York Times works and how my profession works, particularly in that level of the White House press corps as well as the Washington press corps, whoever wrote that was an A-lister. This is someone who has direct knowledge of not only the workings of the West Wing, but more than likely has privileges that would allow this person access to the Oval. And that is a critical, clear distinction. You know, in the tier of who's who in Washington, and Chris, you know this, you're in that town as well as I have been over the years. You know, status is accorded to how close, you know, your little cubicle is in the West Wing, okay, to the Oval. That, you know, it literally, that's not a joke. So this is one of those situations, whoever wrote that thing, and I think Chris is right. I think the person who wrote it was also a source to Bob's book. but this is an extremely senior person. This is an A-lister. And this is someone who's got a detailed working knowledge of exactly what's going on. Now, the person who wrote the op-ed categorized it and framed it in the context of, we're trying to just make sure that he doesn't do too much harm. Now, when you see that, it's like, okay, what exactly is your definition of too much harm? Yeah, you look at every action this reality television star masquerading as a president of the United States has done, and it calls into question your judgment, even making that kind of a statement. So that's kind of what I've been looking at.
Right. No, I agree with you. Here's kind of my deeper question on that, because, you know, this has set up kind of a dramatic, pardon the expression, but reality TV scenario. I mean, it's certainly up at that level of the kind of drama that you would expect from watching reality TV, where not only did this piece come out, it's anonymous, and, you know, it's like it's certainly setting up the drama. You can only imagine what is going on in the walls of the West Wing around this and the book, and just psychologically what it is doing to Donald Trump, who has got to be stepping closer and closer to his ledge with each one of these. I mean, it's almost targeted towards his mental instability. But the one piece of this that I think was fascinating was within this article, towards the end, the author of the article makes a comment and uses the word lodestar. And I have to tell you, I have never used the word lodestar in any of my writing ever. I don't remember seeing the word before it appeared in this particular piece. But people got on it right away and found that it is a favorite use word of none other than Mike Pence, which is either a inadvertent gotcha or a false, you know, something set there. It has to be intentionally to create suspicion. And Brody, I really wanted to get your feedback on that.
That particular word in usage is a peculiar part of the vice president's vernacular when he is writing or speaking. And I do not for a second believe that he authored this piece. But I do think that the fact that that particular phrase was used the way it was used was to throw the scent off in terms of the reality television star who is literally frothing at the mouth. I had a colleague at NBC News tell me that they were getting from sources last night that, you know, Trump essentially lost the plot. I've had White House sources today tell me the exact same thing. The man's stability is just rapidly disappearing. And this may have been something that was intentionally put there that would have caused Trump to kind of veer off course and away from casting aspersions or thoughts towards the actual author of the piece. That's my take on it. Now, I'm sure that the Washington Press Corps, which I'm no longer part of, but my colleagues in Washington, I think, would probably maybe take exception with that or say no. I don't know.
Chris, what are your thoughts?
This is so funny, Brady, because I had the exact same thought. You know, it's a very unusual and archaic word to use, especially in the context of an op-ed like this, in reference to McCain, which would, of course, lead you to think that it might have been Vice President Pence, but I also really doubt that, because I think Pence is somebody who has higher political ambitions and wouldn't author an op-ed like this that could, you know, potentially sink his political career. So I suspect that it was somebody that was trying to create the impression that it was Pence.
I do.
What?
Go ahead.
No, what is going on from your knowledge in the White House now as a result of this kind of double hit? I mean, obviously everybody's denying it. It's all fiction. I mean, this is what they're trying to say on the outside. What is going on inside?
It's a hot mess. It's, again, you're dealing with Trump and a volcanic temper, completely unpredictable, narcissistic, vengeful, revengeful. This person is a master at holding grudges. So you actually have a staff in fear. And that goes from the receptionist of the United States who sits at her little desk as you enter the West Wing all the way down to, you know, the mess stewards. It literally is that bad. And the reason it really is that bad is because this takes a direct hit at the reality that you now have within the administration someone basically stating the case that those of us in the press corps have been making for the last 14 to 18 months. Now you've got an insider saying exactly what we've been reporting on. So it's no longer fake news. You can't contextualize this, as the president would love, as fake news, as lies, as deceptions, as failing this and failing that. It's none of that. This is someone from inside that administration, a significant someone inside that administration, saying, yeah, all of you are correct. He's a nut job, but he's our nut job. We're going to try and keep a lid on it until we come to some sort of, you know, resolute conclusion to this. You know, yeah. Bob's book talks about the trigger of the 25th Amendment. The guy with the op-ed talks about, you know, this guy's a serious problem. You're seeing a dangerous thing here. This is not only just a White House in crisis, but you are also seeing a person who is basically flying apart at the seams. And when it's the president of the United States, that's the very, very last thing you need, because that is probably the most dangerous position in the world I can think of, to have someone who's mentally not stable and flying apart at the seams, period.
Right. The one thing that I kind of worry about in this scenario is that while they're denying the truth of it for external audiences, the things that are true and are resonating, he must know are true, because he can see, you know, how things have come out, and these are now explaining things that he would have seen in front of him. Does he feel he can trust right now? And we know he's a reactionary. What are his likely reactions to all this to be?
Now, Chris is going to say something, but before he does, I'm going to add this. Every person that I've ever dealt with, talked to, interviewed over the past 30 years, where Donald Trump has been part of the conversation, has said the same thing to me. Donald Trump only cares about Donald Trump. He could care less about any other person. And this is what makes this situation even more dangerous. This is a wounded animal. This is an animal that only thinks and cares about himself. He doesn't even care for his own progeny. There is stark photographic evidence of that, just in the way that the first son of the United States, or one of them, but the one that lives in the residence, Barron, the 11-year-old, stays clear of his father, and you can tell there's no relationship there. This defines narcissistic, but it also defines extremely dangerous. And there's the problem. This guy goes up in flames. It's going to be really unfortunate. Chris?
Well, I was going to say a moment ago that it kind of brings into sharp relief some of the allegations that Omarosa made recently. I mean, you know, her credibility is kind of trash, but at the same time, it's also consistent with the narrative that we're seeing from anonymous senior officials and from, you know, Bob Woodward's book and so on. But, you know, the question of who he has to trust, I think, is really crucial. And I think to Brody's point, you know, he really is cornered at this point. You know, he doesn't really have anybody other than family to defend him. You know, his personal lawyer, you know, all of these people, you know, are no longer able to defend him. So I think it'll be really, really telling and really interesting what happens next.
Very much. I want to go to these are actually questions that Chris brought up offline, and even though Chris developed the questions, I want to ask them of both of you about kind of the ethics that have happened within the whole journalistic world around all of these, from the decision by the New York Times to publish an anonymous op-ed, Woodward's use of some secondhand sources, although Brody, you made the point that they weren't all secondhand, and then also a decision by Bloomberg to publish off-the-record comments from President Trump. What is your take on journalistic ethics in these cases?
Ouch. Well, first of all, and since we're starting to run the clock down, I want to give while we're on that subject, a quick shout out to my friends and colleagues at the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association, or meeting for their annual meeting in Palm Springs, California right now. And this is actually probably going to be one of the topics of discussion in the workshops. And so I'm going to take a stab at it. I'm an old school journalist. If a conversation is off the record, it stays off the record. The only exception to the rule that I make is if the information contained within it presents a clear and present danger to the life, okay, of a person or a group of people, or would cause irreparable harm. At that point, I have a responsibility. Outside of that, if it's off the record, it stays there. You know, we oftentimes will take off the record comments and we will incorporate them into background on a story. And there's a way to do that by crafting the story in such a way that we can still relay the information without broaching the confidence of our source. And that's the first thing. The second thing, the ethics of it. We live in a 24/7 news cycle. We live in a hot, you know, topic, Twitter, social feed, Facebook, blah, blah, blah. I think a lot of value has left because everything is just a quick hit, constant, all the time. One of the things that I have, you know, take an exception to is that there's not a lot of good enterprise journalism anymore and good investigative journalism. And as a direct result, and because there's so much out there, and because people don't fact check and they don't do their job and due diligence, you know, charges of, you know, fake news and falsehoods and things does affect the veracity of what we do for a living. That said, I still think it is an imperative for every good journalist to make sure that they get at least two or three sources, they double check what they're doing, and then they present the best possible, truthful, accurate portrayal of the facts and the story. And again, let your listeners, readers, or viewers decide for themselves how they want to interpret it. Our responsibility and our ethics is to do it that way.
Brody, thank you very much. I've got to cut you off because we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for your expertise and brilliance, as always. Christopher Kane, I want to thank you very much for joining us and lending your insight into this conversation. Extremely valuable, and can't wait to have another conversation with you. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in. We will be back again the same time next week, same back channel, same back time. Also listen at 7 p.m. Pacific time to Out in Santa Cruz on www.ksco.com, 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time. We will talk to you again with all the news that you need to know.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.